Okay, it is now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, Jason P. from Fresno, and his inspiration is Rule 62. Don't take yourself so seriously.
All right, can you hear me okay? All right, thank you. Thanks, Brian. Hi, I'm Jason, I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I first got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 16 years old. And the only reason why I was even in that room, because I was hanging out with a buddy of mine. And I was one of those good kids that I was raised in a middle class home, and my dad was a deacon of a Pentecostal church. My grandfather was a minister of a Pentecostal church, and I was pretty damn sheltered. So I started hanging out with the folks that decided to bring a little excitement in my life. And this one kid named Dustin, he was always grounded. He's always getting in trouble. So the only time I could ever hang out with him was if I go met him at an AA meeting. And so I remember going in there, and it was at this place in Fresno. It doesn't exist anymore. It used to be called Eastside Fellowship out at the old winery in Clovis. And it was a rundown building. You know, it was fairly ghetto and kind of a scary place for a 16-year-old. I went into this meeting, and I sat down, and I started listening to people share, and oddly enough, I started being able to identify, with those people, and started understanding and those feelings that they had and we were talking about. I was like, well, shit, I kind of feel like that. And so that was my first meeting, and I didn't go back until probably my senior year. From the very beginning, my alcoholic, patterns, were very glaring. I took after, my dad's side of the family, who have a long line of alcoholics, and it was just very common for me to always have booze in the back of the truck, or at the time I had the 77 El Camino with the cover on it, and no matter where I went, I always had a styrofoam ice chest with booze in the back. I mean, no matter where I went, it was always, fairly stocked up. And my teachers knew what I was doing, and I thought I did a pretty good job of hiding it until one of the my speech teacher. It was a Friday morning, and I was walking across campus with a 1 gallon size orange juice container filled with vodka. And he pulls me aside, and he takes it, and he takes a smell of it, and he just looks at me and says, "You better slow down on that, because I don't want to see you throwing up here, by end of second period." Okay, that sounds like good advice, right? Like a lot of alcoholic, high school kids, I was terrible at school. I didn't, I barely went, and I was, joined the military, and I had to graduate so I can take off to Virginia for some training. And my high school, counselor pulled me in the office and says, "Look, you're not going to graduate if you don't pass these classes." Okay, yes, whatever, I'll take care of it. And then she looks at me and says, "You don't have to give me any details. I just want you to say yes or no." And she's got real serious, and she looked at me and she says, "Do you think you may or may not have a problem with drugs or alcohol?" And even without thinking about it, I just looked at her and I said, "Absolutely." And so she gave me my first AA schedule. And so what I found out really quick is if I say I'm going to go to an AA meeting, they will excuse my absences, and it's not a problem. And It just happened to be the last month of my senior year, and I'm, by the grace of God, I managed to graduate. And during that 30-day period, which I actually got a 30-day chip, but during that 30-day period, there was this old guy at one of the new meetings I was going to, and I told him about one of the problems I was having with one of my shop instructors. And I hated the guy. I mean, I really didn't hate him. I just hated authority, like most of us alcoholics. And I was failing that class. And so this, I was crying about it in this meeting, and this old guy says, you know, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go to this teacher. You're going to tell him you're an alcoholic, and you're going to do whatever it takes to, finish all the work. You're going to make up your tests, and you can do whatever it takes to graduate. So I did that with my tail between my legs, went in there and begged and told him that I was willing to do whatever, and I'm an alcoholic, and this and that. And so he let me do the work. I took the final, got an F on the final, and the guy passed me with a D-. And so, I mean, that was really my first amends I'd ever had to make in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then graduation night, went out and got smashed and continued to drink for 3 years. Then came back when I was 21. Because by then, I couldn't sleep through the night without having alcohol available for me to put me back to sleep and to get rid of the shakes. Most of my friends, while a lot of them were partiers, even at that point in time, I was already drinking more than they were willing to put up with. It wasn't so much the amount I was drinking, it was my actions. And getting myself into trouble and telling people off and just all the typical alcoholic behavior. So I got sober back then. That sobriety date was May 22nd, 2001. And I thought for sure I was going to keep that for the rest of my life. Later on the story, I'll tell you that wasn't my last sobriety date. But I did manage to stay sober from May of 2001 to August of 2007. And as a young person, I mean, that was really difficult for me. Because I never, always had that, felt like there was that stigma of being an alcoholic. I knew that I was a drunk, and I knew that I was, an alcoholic, and that, I did bad things, and it kept me going for 6 years, and I was really active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into service with H&I. For those of you who don't know, it's hospitals and institutions. Was a coordinator for Cedar Vista Hospital in Fresno for a while. Went out to many panels out at WestCare. Went to conferences anywhere from all over California. I went to one back east in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And that's a really interesting story. It's kind of another men's story. During that time frame, I got really close to these two guys, and some of you guys may know the names, named Matt Green. Had a lot of time sober, and he had a real powerful story, and I hung out with him a lot, and he was blind. He couldn't see because he had shot himself in the face with a shotgun, and so a lot of people drove him around, and if Matt was going to speak at a conference, then he's always allowed to bring someone to chaperone him. And it was about time I was to make amends for my biological father. I hadn't really been there most of my life. And I knew that he lived in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and I didn't know how I was going to be able to get a hold of him. Well, I finally did. And we were at the men's meeting one morning, Saturday morning, and I was talking to Matt, and I was telling him how I was going back to Arkansas to make this amends to my father, and he just looked at me, and he said, "Well, which part of Fort Smith, or which part of Arkansas?" And I said, "Well, a little town called Fort Smith, Arkansas." And he just gave me this look, and he says, well, guess what? He says, I just happen to be speaking in Fort Smith, Arkansas here in about 3 months. Would you like to go back there with me so, you know, you can be at this convention and you can make amends to your dad? And I was just like, all right. I mean, that was one of those things where God was just, you know, was able to make something happen, which, you know, I no way could have planned it out any better. And so I went back there and I made amends to that father, and that was probably back in 2005, 2006-ish. And, you know, came back, was still doing the deal until probably about 2006, and I moved from Fresno to Lemoore, and, you know, I stopped going to meetings, and for about a year, I seemed to do okay. You know, I stayed sober, and at that point in time, it almost just like sobriety was just a way of life. And then I started, you know, that spiritual part of me was just, I mean, there was no spiritual part of me. I lost that program. I lost my connection with God. You know, I got into a relationship and went through a breakup, and I was completely miserable, and I started going and hanging out in bars just to shoot pool and play and drink Red Bull, and everybody knows about the story of, you know, hanging out in a barbershop long enough. You know, hanging out in a barbershop long enough, you're going to get a haircut. Well, if you hang out at a bar long enough, you're going to take a drink eventually. And I did. And so that was August 2007. And for probably the first year, I would say, I was, the craving came back, but I didn't really enjoy my drinking because I could either not control my drinking and enjoy it, or control my drinking, or at least try to, and not enjoy it. And that first year, I really didn't enjoy it because I was, you know, just wanted to control it to prove myself that I was a non-alcoholic. And it just so happens that I was an alcoholic, and the drinking just got worse. And this time around, I found the wonderful world of pharmaceuticals, and that's what I found with pharmaceuticals is, you know, my favorite word, opiates, is they did, you know, what alcohol can do for me on those real bad times, you know, those opiates could. So that started just a downward spiral for, you know, six, you know, from August 2007 to my current sobriety date is June 13th, 2012, and, you know, up until that point, I mean, I couldn't look myself in the mirror. I had become so secluded in life. I just like a hermit. I didn't like to go out and drink. I didn't like to go out and party. I didn't like to be around people. And it just turned into this unnatural fear of being around people. So I would just sit at home and just be depressed. Well, now during that time, you know, I'd gotten into, you know, a long-term relationship, which was a really sick relationship. And when it came to an end in 2011, any reserve or basically my drinking, my alcohol and drug addiction, just there was no holding back, no holds barred at that point in time. You know, if you're going to do it right. And it just got to the point where it was just me at home, a bottle of pills and a bottle of Johnny Walker Black, and I was happy and content with that. While I was miserable and, you know, sent out home, you know, just hating myself, hating life, hating everybody else around me, just full of self-pity. And around December of 2011, part of that breakup I went through, you know, the girl, you know, she finally got sick of my drinking and what I did on, you know, how I treated her and treated her kids. And which is odd. The funny part, so when I met her, I was sober, and she always tried to get me to drink, and she was actually kind of happy that I started drinking again. But give her about a few years, and her tune changed. And so we went through this breakup, and I was sitting at home in December, and I was trying to get her back, and I was going to prove that I could stay sober. And I didn't drink for about 3 weeks, and the pharmaceuticals ran out, and I was sitting at home, skin's crawling, and it was, at that point in time, it was just contemplating suicide. But it's really too chicken shit to really do it right. So I pulled out the 44 Magnum, stuck one round in it, and I spun it, and put it to my head and pulled the trigger. And it didn't go off. And it scared the shit out of me. And I just remember when I was sober from previous years, this guy, his name is Dave, he was talking to me about suicidal tendencies and alcoholism, and he says if it gets to the point where it's either taking a drink or killing yourself, go ahead and take that drink, because then you may be given another day to survive and get through those problems. And so I remember that, and so I went out, so I continued to drink. That's really all I knew. I had no tools about how to deal with what I was going through in life. But I knew I didn't want to go back to AA yet. I wasn't ready for that. Even though all those phone numbers of all the people that I knew from those previous years, I had never gotten rid of them from my phone. Even when we had the phones back then where you can automatically transfer the numbers, I manually put those numbers in there. Because I knew I was an alcoholic, and someday, if I could live through it, then I would end up back in these rooms. So I fast forward to probably about 6 months till June. June 12th, the night of my last drink. I had a friend over. It was a neighbor. She came over, and we were hanging out, finishing off, that Johnny Walker Black. And she went home, and I took an Ambien, went to bed, and then woke up the following morning and laying in a hospital bed in 4-point restraints, not knowing how in the hell I even got there. What happened? No clue, complete blackout. And the only time I was ever a blackout drinker is when I mix it with Ambien. That stuff is just nasty. I don't know if you guys ever experienced that, but it's nothing to joke around about. So I was laying in that bed, and the only thing I really remember at first was just telling myself that, hey, I don't know what I did, but they already think you're crazy, so don't do anything to prove them right. And so I just went back to sleep. Finally, they took me to a little secured padded room, I finally woke up, and I was just like, what the hell happened? Because again, I really had no idea. The only thing I remember was taking an Ambien and going to bed. So I was sitting there, and the security guard's looking at me, and he finally says, he goes, you've never been in here, have you? I said, no, this is a first timer for me. And I go, so what did I do? Am I under arrest? He goes, no, if you're under arrest, you'd be in handcuffs. I'm like, okay, so do you have any idea why I'm here? So he pulls out some paperwork, which happened to be the police report. It said, well, it says something about alcohol and firing a gun in your home. And I'm like, all right, so then at that point I had to finally call somebody, and so it was either calling my mom or my sister, because those are the only phone numbers that I had memorized. And so I called my sister and told her that I was in the hospital, and during my drinking career for the past like 6 years, from that time frame. I was in the hospital for a lot of reasons, mainly all due to alcoholism. You know, my health was extremely poor. So I called her up and she says, well, when are they going to let you out? I said, I don't know. I said, I'm told that they can keep me in here for 72 hours. And she's like, what the hell, Jason? What'd you do? I said, I don't know. So finally, I was able to talk to the social worker, and then I only had to spend about 6 hours in there because I basically just convinced them that, hey, I'm not as crazy as they think I am. And apparently, they agreed, so they went ahead and let me go. My sister was there to pick me up and took me home. And when I got in there, it looked like a crime scene. And there was blood everywhere, all over the house, bullet holes in the walls and the floor. The window, the back window had was completely busted out. And the only thing I could do was, you know, try to piece things together. I was able to talk to the neighbor, who just happened to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous. And he had the pleasure of watching everything I did from his backyard. Once he heard the gunshots, he basically just sat back there and waited for me to run out of ammo. So they called the cops, and the cops came out first, and they said, look, we're not going to go in this guy's house. I mean, he's not shooting anymore. And if he's just a drunk guy shooting around his house, you know, we don't want to go in there and, you know, just and kill him. So if he's in there, he's dead. If he's, you know, maybe he'll wake up in the morning, but who knows? And that same girl that had drank the night before, as soon as the cops left, she came and broke into the house and found me laying there. I had fell through the living room window, big cut in the back of my head. I was bleeding out all over the carpet and tile. And I mean, I was literally moments away from death. If she hadn't done that, you know, I would have died. I would have died within the hour. And all I know is when I was sitting in that padded room, I said, man, I think I need to stop. And I mean, I wasn't completely convinced I was ready to stop drinking yet, but I knew all I wanted was to get the law off my back, get my family off my back, and eventually get my guns back. And I did, by the way. So I called out the old sponsor of mine that the number was in my phone, and told him I was ready to come back, and went back to my first meeting. And within a couple of weeks, I was told about this young people's group that was called All California Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a big conference of about 2,300 young people that were coming to Fresno, and that there was a committee that was hosting that conference. And it's a really big thing because it goes through different cities throughout California and never the same place 2 years in a row. And so I said, well, let me go check those guys out. But if I'm going to do something, I might as well, you know, not be completely bored. So I took my sponsor's advice, drove over to where they're holding the business meeting, sat in the parking lot, and I saw someone from that group get out of the car and go up to the door. And I was so fearful that I just started crying and I left. Following Monday, you know, called my sponsor and told him, and he says, well, so how's business meeting? I said, I didn't go. He said, why not? He said, well, I was scared. He goes, well, you know, just go back and do it again. So I went back the following week, well, the following every 2 weeks. In the parking lot and full of that same fear and self-loathing, and saw someone get out and go open the door, and I took off, just started crying, and I took off. And I, following Monday, called my sponsor, told him the same thing. Well, so finally on the third time, I finally went into that business meeting, and I was so scared and had no idea what I was going to be doing what they were doing. You know, I didn't know who these people were. They sure as hell didn't know who I was. And I just sat there and just kind of like chaos in my head. And I got hooked up with this group and got involved with the committee. And the most ironic part is, you know, me being so fearful and being such a, you know, secluded hermit, I ended up getting a position being a volunteer coordinator for the conference. I don't know if anybody's ever had an experience with trying to coordinate some volunteers. You've got to be in contact with people. And our very first event, I was calling to try to get some volunteers set up, and every call that I made, each person wanted to talk to me for like an hour and a half. I never got anything done because everybody wanted to get to know me, and it just scared the shit out of me. And I mean, I would go to these what they call subcommittee meetings, where they try to plan some of these events, and I would get there, I would sit there, I'd do my job, not really say a whole lot, and as soon as it was over, I would get in my car and take off, and they would look at me like, where the hell's he going? Why doesn't he stick around? I mean, I couldn't at that point in my sobriety. I mean, I could barely, you know, get out of bed in the morning and just enough to be able to hang out and be somewhat social. And besides, my only plan was just to get everybody off my back, and then when that happens, I was going to continue to drink. I was not yet convinced that this thing with alcoholism was going to kill me. And well, we had this conference, just amazing conference, you know, 2,300 people in downtown Fresno, just awesome recovery, a bunch of fun. And then once that was over, it ended on a Sunday, I went on the way home. I had made that decision that I was going to, I thought I made a decision that I was going to drink. It was all done. My commitment to the committee was done. I did my part. Everything was back to normal, quasi-normal. So I went and sat in front of a liquor store and contemplated for about 15 minutes whether I was going to, you know, start going back to the old life, because it's even after about 9 months, and that's where it was at that point, the old life was still a lot more comfortable and appealing, no matter what the consequences are going to be. But during that time, that 15-minute time frame, I finally realized that if I did that, I was going to die an alcoholic death that it talks about in the Big Book. So I ended up going ahead and made the decision not to drink and continued on with my program. And I've stayed sober for almost 3 years, well, over 3 years now, just as of about a week ago. And I tell you what, the only way that's happened was because of a God of my understanding and getting into service. You know, I try not to take myself too seriously when it comes to life and most things, but you ask the people that are here on the committee when it comes to service and being of service to alcoholics, I take that very seriously. Because, you know, for me to be able to stay sober now, I got to be able to reach out and be able to help another alcoholic. And I do realize today that if I ever drink again, that there may be a chance I won't come back and I will die an alcoholic death. I am the alcoholic that it talks about in the Big Book. If I continue to drink, I'll be locked up or I'm going to die. There is nothing in this world besides, you know, my spiritual relationship with God that keeps me sober. And I've stayed connected with this AA group, this young people group, which we know now known as FICCIPAW, the Fresno County Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started a young people meeting in Clovis. It's a What's Up with the Big Book young people meeting. What's up? And that's one of the best things I could have ever done. You know, got me into service, and life is just wonderful today. Sometimes I wish that I knew what happened that night at that I shot at my house, and because there is one piece of that story that I don't know if it was the hand of God or just pure luck. About 3 days after that whole incident happened, you know, my family had me on 30-day lockdown. I couldn't, here I was, you know, in my 30s and grounded by my family. I couldn't go anywhere without, unless it was going to a meeting. They allowed me to go to meetings. So I just came home one night after the meeting, and my mom was just crying. And I'm like, well, what's going on? And she reaches in her pocket and pulls out a bullet. And but at this point in time, we didn't think any of the bullets left the house. I mean, some of the bullets went into multiple bedrooms, bounced around. But so she pulls out this bullet. She goes, I found this outside. I'm like, what? Not outside? I didn't think anything left. And so basically, the only thing I could figure is most likely is my last shot when I was laying on the ground. I shot my cupboards, and the bullet went through two cupboards, exited the house, and just fell down. It just fell to the ground after about 1 inch. If it had gone any further, it most likely would have hit the neighbor's house or could have even killed somebody. I don't know why. You know, maybe it's just physics. Maybe it was God. I really don't know. And at this point, it's not really worth arguing or even trying to worry about it. As long as I, you know, reach out to other young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, we are trying to bring Acupaw to Visalia. Fikipaw, we bet every year, and we want to bring the conference to Visalia. I know there's a lot of young people in this room, and if anybody's interested in being part of that group, you know, we meet second and fourth Sunday of every month at North Park Church. Our North Park Fellowship is Bethany Church. We can use some people from this area to kind of be our eyes and ears and to help spread the word. We have some events coming up as well. We have our annual broomball game, which at the Gateway Ice Center on July 18th. We'll be meeting at Fresno Fellowship beforehand at 8:30 for the young people's meeting, then broomball directly afterwards. And then we have our annual camp out September 18th through the 20th at Pine Flat Lake. And we've been doing that for the past 3 or 4 years. It's an awesome time. And we've also, the committee's been asked to get involved with the Northern California Council of Alcoholics Anonymous, their conference that's coming up. When is this? October 30th, 31st, and the 1st. So it's an awesome time to be able to get into service. If anybody is interested, you can talk to myself or anybody in the front row that's raising their hands. I'd be more than glad to be able to give you some more information. You can check out our website. It's at fcypaa.com, fikipaw.com. You know, we just try to stay busy in sobriety. And, I was told by somebody that if you're bored in sobriety, well, maybe you're just a fucking boring person, but because there's a lot to do. So with that, I think I'm done. So I just want to thank you guys for inviting me. Unfortunately, Bill isn't here tonight. I was really hoping to be able to thank him for letting me come down. Anytime I get anybody asks me to speak, as much as I hate speaking, it's just one of those parts of service that you just can't say no. So thanks for your time, and I'll keep coming back. Thanks.
Thank you, Jason. Okay, the Valley Group encourages sponsorship and service to our fellowship. We invite you to come early and stay after the meeting to get better acquainted with our fellowship.